Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Evan Ashkin, Associate Professor in the University of North Carolina's Family Medicine Department, about his journeys as a family physician around the country, internationally, and in somewhat different capacities. It should be really interesting.
A remarkable man. I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, Adam, we've got some research that matters, and we also have our weekend warrior, Dr. Tim Taft, with us today.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what kind of accidents have happened to some of his patients, including me, frequently. But first, Christy, let's talk about two interesting research studies on different ends of the age spectrum, one about babies and how to reduce pain, and the other about losing weight for people who are overweight. Some really pretty interesting research.
Well, and these are both relevant to my life. The first one is about something called kangaroo care, which is something that...
Little babies hopping? No.
It's about premature infants having skin-to-skin contact with a mom or dad. And there have been studies showing that there are some benefits to that skin-to-skin contact. I personally... was introduced to this when I had a premature baby myself, and it was something, a way to get my husband involved, to have skin-to-skin contact with the baby and to let me have that experience too. And, you know, supposedly there's less pain and some benefits to the baby from having that kind of warmth and regulation of the breathing and intimacy.
Well, yeah, and this sounds very interesting and appropriate. And after, I want to ask you, why would it only be for preemie babies? Why not for all babies? But this research in the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine looked at 62 premature babies who were in the neonatal intensive care unit. This was out of Canada, and they needed multiple needles into the heel to draw blood. Heel sticks is what they're called. And for each of these procedures, they looked at having the baby's mother or the father alternate holding this baby the kangaroo care, and then looked at the faces of the babies during and after the blood draw to look at things like pain.
And in this particular study, there were benefits in reduction of pain scores when the babies had skin-to-skin contact with a parent. And in this particular one, there was a slight difference between mom and dad, with some better scores when mom held the baby versus dad. But I think the point here is that there may be some benefits to skin-to-skin contact.
Not that mothers are better than fathers.
No, it's such a great way that dads can be involved.
Well, and the difference between the mother and the fathers was not nearly as great as the difference between having this close skin-to-skin contact and not having that contact. Well, that's the take-home message. You're absolutely right.
And to get back to your point earlier, Adam, skin-to-skin contact is showing all kinds of benefits for all babies. So we're really promoting early breastfeeding in the hospital right after birth and early skin-to-skin contact, even right after cesarean sections. We try to get that baby skin-to-skin within an hour breastfeeding. And so those benefits are coming out in the research now. We really should have Allison Stubbe on the show. She's an expert at this, to talk about that.
I think that just sounds like a good idea. Well, let's talk about some interesting research, and you said you had some interest in this as well. We have some other research that matters here. A really interesting article that was about Weight Watchers, and I know that you've spoken on Your Health before, Christy, about Weight Watchers being a really good program, and I've always said, yes, I respect you. I respect you fully, but I also said, well, where's the beef? Where's the evidence, so to speak? And now we have a research study.
I usually say the evidence is in my waistline because I always talk about Weight Watchers. And the truth is, I'm not paid by Weight Watchers or anything, but I do support it because it's been effective for me and many patients. In this study, it was the first randomized control trial looking to compare a commercial weight loss program with standard care by family doctors. And in this case, they found that Weight Watchers was more than twice as effective.
Yeah, this was published in The Lancet, so it's a very, very good journal. And they took 772 patients that were overweight and or obese in Australia, Germany, and Britain. And they did find that there was a significant difference at the end of a year. Though I was a little disappointed in the overall amount of weight loss at the end of 1 year, Christy. It was the average weight loss for those using Weight Watchers was 11 pounds versus those who didn't use Weight Watchers lost about 5 pounds. So, yes, it was significantly more, but it wasn't like for a lot of people where they have to be as 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds.
But that was for the entire group, anyone who was recommended to do Weight Watchers. The folks who kept with it for the full 12 months lost more weight.
You know, absolutely. And the other thing we should mention is that they did get this program for free. Mm-hmm. Now, if they had to pay for it, that may have made
it better.
And so we should mention that. And it was paid for, this program, by Weight Watchers, but the study was independently done, and we think it's a good study. So I don't think there's a downside here, really. I'm in support of this.
Yeah, I still say if you have a weight loss program that works for you, stick with that. But if you're looking for something new and you can afford it or find a coupon for it, Weight Watchers can be effective.
Now we want to welcome back Dr. Tim Taft to Your Health, our weekend warrior. It's good to have you back on Your Health, Dr. Taft.
Well, it's good to be here.
I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well, and, you know, it's nice to have a couple of football wins under our belt.
Yeah, you're working hard here in the middle of the season.
Well, it depends on you say
anyway.
The football wins. You're talking about the University of North Carolina. I'm sure you're not talking about East Chapel Hill High School, which one of my kids goes to. And right now they're still struggling for that win. But, you know, speaking of football, I understand that there's a lot of injuries that seem to happen. What do you have for us today?
Well, one of the things that we've got going on right now is we've had some flexor tendon ruptures.
Flexor tendon.
What does that mean?
In the hand. The flexor tendons are the tendons that work when you make a fist, when you flex your fingers to ball them up into a fist. And what happens is that it's usually a defensive player who reaches out to grab someone, grabs hold of their jersey. The person doesn't want to be grabbed, and so they continue to run. And the fellow is strong enough, and then his grip is strong enough, that the tendon itself actually ruptures as he's trying to hold on to someone who's running away from him.
That sounds painful.
It is fairly painful.
Yeah.
And it usually involves the ring finger, although it can involve either the long finger or the small finger. And one of the reasons for that is it's kind of interesting that if you look at your hand and you make about half a fist, in most people, the ring finger in that position is actually the longest finger. And so that's the one that gets hung up on the jersey, called the jersey finger, when the tendon itself ruptures as the ball carrier is trying to get away.
Christy and I are both doing that right now,
and
we're totally amazed. Like, how did that finger get to be so big?
It is longer. So how does a player know? So they've reached out, grabbed the jersey, they're strong enough, and then I imagine it's painful. But how do you know that you've damaged your hand to that degree?
Well, they know they've been hurt. One, it is painful. It's not terribly painful, but it is painful. They usually feel or hear a pop or snap, and then all of a sudden they realize that they cannot bend the finger. When they try to make a fist, all the other fingers come down, and that guy just sticks out there reasonably straight.
Oh.
And so they know they can't bend it.
Do most people, will they end up seeing their doctor or the orthopedist fairly quickly, or will they just say, "Oh, you know, this is a jam finger. I'm gonna stick tape around it to the fourth finger next to it and see if it heals."
Keep playing.
Keep playing.
Now, normally they know that something is wrong, and one of the good things about this injury, if you wish, is that they usually don't sit on it. It's not very subtle. They know that they can't bend it. They felt it pop. They know that something's wrong, and then when they go back out, this thing is sticking out there, and it gets caught on stuff. So most of the time, these people will be seen within 24 hours. They'll seek care. And when you examine them, you just ask them to make a fist, and normally all the fingers should come down together, and this one doesn't.
So what do you do?
The only thing you really can do is to go in and surgically repair it.
No, you can do that.
we can exactly.
do that. And it is usually a season-ending injury, which many of the players find to be incredibly frustrating. I mean, they'll say, look, it's just a pinky, or it's just my ring finger. You mean I'm going to miss the whole year because of that?
Wow.
And the answer is yes, because you have to go in and pull the tendon back out to the bone where it's supposed to be and reattach it, and then that takes 10 or 12 weeks to heal down.
Well, and wow. I imagine every athlete understands that they need their hand, but even beyond that sport, your hand is so important to everything that we do, that I imagine there's some element of you as a physician needing to help them see the forest for the trees.
Well, that's true, and this is a thing that while they've got a long wait for their recovery, the recovery is generally very good, and these folks end up with excellent normal hand function.
And what's that pinky used for normally?
Adam's challenging. Do they really need their hand?
I mean, you know.
It's helpful if you're the queen and drinking tea.
Well, do you need it to rest when you're writing?
I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to figure this
out
here.
Your ring finger? You need to wear your wedding ring?
you don't want it sticking out there because it gets caught on stuff. And then you've got to have strength of flexion so that you can carry things like suitcases and briefcases. And the other place that another major function that you'll lose is keyboarding, is that if you can't flex it, you won't be able to type very well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Dr. Taft, we appreciate you bringing this to because it is something that is uncommon, perhaps, but with football season and maybe some other sports, that tendon ruptures are something that you and primary care doctors and a lot of people probably will see.
Yep, and if you do, then that's one of the things that we think need to be referred to us, because usually they require surgical repair.
Yep. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Taft. We've been talking with Dr. Tim Taft from the UNC Department of Orthopedics. Thank you so much.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
We'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Bye.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Associate Professor in the UNC Family Medicine Department, Dr. Evan Ashkin, about Journeys of a Family Physician. And Adam and I are so excited to have you with us, Dr. Ashkin, to really tell us about the variety of practice settings that you've been in and your real commitment to taking care of underserved populations in our state and across the world.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks, Christy and Adam.
No, Dr. Ashkin, one of the things that I think a lot of people, when they think about physicians, are that they graduate from medical school and residency and they go into a setting and that's where they stay. But that really isn't true. And your path, and I think one of the things that interested Christy and I, is that you have a really interesting path through medicine that has had a variety of different places where you've gone. And I wonder how you can tell us, how did you first decide when you decided to become a family physician, how did you first decide upon your first job and what was it?
Well, when I started medical school, I'm not even sure I knew what family medicine was. I grew up in New York and there were not many good models there for family medicine or general practice, a lot of specialty care. But I knew going into med school that my interest was in taking care of patients who had less access to care and what we would consider now that I have the language, underserved patients. And as soon as I heard the word family medicine, I was in medical school in Boston at Tufts University.
Which did not have a department of family medicine, I know, because I went there for an undergraduate, and I knew for many years it was one of the last schools to have family medicine, so this was highly unusual.
Yeah, it was. A matter of fact, it did not have a department, and it was a somewhat hostile environment to wanting to go into family medicine. But I knew that that field, I'm a real dilettante, and I was not going to be able to limit what I wanted to do in caring for patients. I wanted to be able to take care of newborn babies and care for them as they grew and care for their parents and grandparents. And clearly, family medicine was the field that was going to let me do that. Unfortunately, at Tufts, I was told that as a family physician, I really probably wouldn't be able to do those things, that I would not be able to get admitting privileges at university hospitals. I had a real interest in teaching, and I was told I probably wouldn't be able to teach as well, certainly wouldn't be able to deliver babies. But happily, I was stubborn enough not to believe that at the time and continued on my path. And I found some wonderful mentors in the Boston area who were general practitioners, and in family medicine were the heirs of that general practice. But then realized that I probably needed to leave the Northeast to get a training that I felt was going to support my desire to be a family physician.
And so where did you go to train?
I pretty much picked the furthest place I could get from Boston, which was San Francisco, staying in the U.S., and had heard wonderful things about the family medicine department at University of California, San Francisco. And they had a really wonderful program based at San Francisco General Hospital, which was the hospital that cared for the indigent in San Francisco. And interestingly, it also turned out in some ways to be the peak of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco. When I say the peak, meaning the period of time where people were sick from HIV disease, but we didn't have any effective treatments for them.
And so you discovered somehow, magically as a student in an environment where no one else was choosing family medicine, that family medicine gave you both the care of families, but this opportunity to take care of vulnerable populations. And that's how did you figure out that family medicine was the, I mean, obviously lots of doctors and specialties take care of people who need it, but how did you feel that family medicine was that fit for you to then go seek out that training?
Well, I think some of it was just luck in that I really didn't know that clearly and didn't probably have the right role models at that time to be sure of that. It was more the faith that having the skills to care for a human being from birth through the end of life, having those skills would allow me to work in an environment where I could see anyone who came in the door. So I think mostly I just believed that with the background of family medicine training, I'd be able to care for the range of patients I might see. And at that point, I wasn't clear whether that was going to be here in the U.S. or perhaps overseas as well.
You know, let's leap forward for a second, because you've now had a medical school on the East Coast, and you were raised, I think, in Chicago.
New York, and then a little bit in Chicago.
A little bit in Chicago, and then you're out to the West Coast. And then all of a sudden, your first job after residency, you come back to New York.
Yes.
And tell us about that job and how that came about and what that experience was like for you.
So I wound up at Albany Medical College. My wife, as I was finishing residency, looked at me and said, well, I think now I'm going to go to med school. And I took a swallow and a deep breath and said, wonderful, dear. And we wound up in
Good
Albany.
Answer.
We wound up in Albany, New York. And it was a wonderful department there. Actually, one of the first women leaders in family medicine, Alice Fruin, was the chairman at the time. And I had the opportunity there to move the department toward caring for underserved patients. They had not had a faculty member really with that interest in particular at the time, and there was a lot of interest in the student body and among our residents, and I had a wonderful position there and started a homeless shelter clinic with med students. And it was also, I have to say, a bit of a recruiting tool for family medicine. There were not many other opportunities for med students to work clinically in their first and second year, and the students were very interested in this opportunity. So we started that program, and every Wednesday night we went to different homeless shelters in Albany, and the program, I'm happy to say, is much larger than it was then and is still going today.
So you are the founder of this health project for the homeless with medical students in the area?
I was at the time, and There have been some fabulous people who have carried on that work. And in particular, there was a medical student at the time who has went on to found a clinic in a similar neighborhood in Albany, who went through our family medicine department. And he basically lives in this part of town where most of us would be afraid to walk, and opened the doors. And there is absolutely no fee for any of his services. He and his family, his wife's a nurse, actually run this clinic there. He's actually won the, I believe it was the AAMC award.
Association of American Medical Colleges.
Yes, for service in the past few years.
But, you know, we're talking with Dr. Evan Ashkin, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the University of North Carolina, and we've heard kind of the east to the west, the north, south. You journeyed south. Right before we break, tell us, how did you decide? You said we need to explore the entire United
yes.
States. We haven't been in the South. What happened?
Well, I have friends who have lived here for many years, and we'd come and visited them in North Carolina, and so I knew the area a bit, and I knew the reputation of the department at UNC, and I had met some of the folks in my work with predoctoral education at Albany Med, and after following my wife from med school and residency, it was her turn to follow me. And but she was very happy to come down here as well. These friends are good friends of hers as well. So at that time, when she finished her residency, I contacted the department, and there was an opportunity for me to come and join the group here in family medicine.
Well, we are certainly glad you did, and we're looking forward to hearing the next chapter of your life in North Carolina, your work in Honduras and in many settings globally, and the impact that you've had as a teacher as well. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Evan Ashkin, about Journeys of a Family Physician. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. We've been talking with Dr. Evan Ashkin, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about his journeys as a family physician. And Dr. Ashkin, I wonder, before we really jump into some of the work that you've done during the last decade here in North Carolina and internationally, are there any experiences that really stand out in your mind? You wanted to go into medicine to see and be able to care for people at all ages, spectrums, adults, prenatal, teaching of medical students. What influences really occurred to you in that first decade?
Well, Adam, when I was in my residency, I was in my internship, my first year at San Francisco General Hospital. I had a senior resident who I think really, in one real act of kindness, I think taught me a lesson I'll never forget about really caring for the patient. We were called to the emergency room very late one night. We were all tired, working too many hours, and there was a very difficult patient who should be admitted because he was having chest pain, but didn't want to come in. And I was very prepared to bring out this form. It's called Leaving Against Medical Advice, and we would happily give him this form. He'd sign it, and we'd go back to bed, and he'd leave the hospital. And my resident turned to this gentleman who, I won't get into details, but everyone in the ER knew he was there, and said, well, you know, really, why is it that you will leave? And he said, well, someone needs to feed my cats. And my resident turned to him and said, well, we'll go feed your cats. Where do you live? And he lived in an awful hotel in the Tenderloin, which was not a nice part of San Francisco. And this guy looked at us to really see if we were serious. And I looked at my resident to see if he was actually serious. And he was. And we took this gentleman's keys and in the middle of the night went to this Tenderloin Hotel and fed his cats and changed the cat box and did some other tasks needed done. And I realized at that moment that, you know, this was really why I was there. The point was to take care of this gentleman and to assist him in however he needed to be assisted, to see what was in his best interest. And that act of compassion and kindness has really stuck with me probably every day seeing patients.
know, that reminds me of some of your work with Community Care of North Carolina and some of these projects that you've been involved in that are very focused on taking care of patients who need assistance and thinking more than just what medicines are we going to prescribe them. How have you, in your journey through private practice and then coming back into academic medicine, give us a little taste of some of those projects that you've been involved in to really look at how can we care for the whole patient?
Well, I think, you know, Christy and Adam, I'm sure like you guys, at times you see the same medical problems occurring over and over again, and you realize that they're happening to patients because of broader social problems that they may be experiencing. And happily, North Carolina has a very progressive attitude, I believe, toward the care of chronically sick Medicaid and indigent patients. And one of the ways we address working with those patients is through Community Care North Carolina. And I've been fortunate to work with them, helping to design programs for chronically sick Medicaid patients who may suffer from severe diabetes, congestive heart failure, kidney disease, or even severe mental health problems. And working with very fine, dedicated nurse case managers, working with their primary care docs, we're able to create some wraparound services that can really assist these patients in meeting the goals that they want for their own well-being and their health.
Give us an example. What kind of things are you talking about that?
Well, I mean, a very simple example would be assisting a mom with her kids in transportation back and forth to the doctor's office and obtaining medications.
So she might not be coming to the doctor's office because she has no transportation, and we say no-show.
Exactly.
This patient's no-show. It's the third time they've no-showed, and now we say you can't come to our practice anymore.
Or they show, but they show late because they've been on a bus with four children, and they're 20 minutes after their appointment, and they're turned away. So helping patients use the system in a way that can get their needs met. But beyond that, our nurses and social workers address really the wide range of needs a patient may have that affects their health, which can be helping to get their family involved in meeting some needs they have, food, transportation, heating, all the essential things that most of us take for granted that really have a very large negative impact on someone if they have chronic medical problems.
And so that is and such an important model, and it's really one that's nationally recognize what we're doing here in this state with Community Care of North Carolina. But through your teaching and through your involvement in patient care, you've also expanded these concepts and your training to help people on a global level with medical students in Honduras and other places. Give us a little taste of how that came about, that you're accompanying medical students to teach them some of this in an international setting.
It wasn't enough that you were just taking care of your patients, feeding those cats.
Feeding
cats
wasn't enough.
You had to go, Dr. Ashkin, and you know, take care of populations. And you started out the uninsured there in Albany and then the Medicaid population. And then as Christy says, you know, it wasn't enough.
Well, you know,
how did this come about?
First of all,
I
don't believe in altruism. This is all, I really enjoy all this. This is what makes me feel good. And basically, you know, medical students are idealistic, energetic. They're full of life. They want to help. Unfortunately, this is truer earlier in their training than later. So, but I love the energy and I love working with those students and I love having the opportunity to assist them in fulfilling their dream of really becoming an important part of their community. So there's many opportunities, and one that I have done is for the last 6 years, taking medical students to a town called Juventino Rosas in central Mexico. It's a sister city of Chapel Hill. The relationship started with St. Thomas More, the Catholic Church, and there's a very strong relationship between that diocese in Mexico and in Chapel Hill, and working with Dr. Sandy Clark, a wonderful family physician at Carrboro Community Health Center. We have taken first and some second-year medical students down to Mexico, doing health education in some very rural communities. And it's been a very meaningful experience and hopefully has helped these students see the potential for this kind of work throughout their career.
Well, I know your passion does come through in teaching both our residents and in the medical students. And I think hopefully and certainly has convinced dozens and generations of new learners to go into family medicine. And it seems like that you have a new challenge. I've just heard that you and some of your colleagues in family medicine are the subject of a new grant to take on another challenge in caring for underserved. Tell us a little bit about this new opportunity you're going to be looking at.
Sure. Well, working closely with Dr. Page, who is the program director for our family medicine residency, and Dr. Clark Denniston, we have started a new track in our residency training program where two medical students who want to be family docs will come to our program to do their 3 years of family medicine residency, and they will join this underserved medicine track. And we are partnering with Piedmont.
What does that mean? What does that mean, underserved medicine track? What does that mean?
Right. Well, it means that the focus of their residency training will be to prepare them to have the skills, not just medical skills, but maybe community medicine skills, to be able to really engage a rural or underserved community and really feel like they are an effective member of that community and an effective healthcare provider. And we've been very fortunate to get a grant from the North Carolina Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation, as well as recently got a grant through HRSA from the federal government to help fund the development of this training program. And I was going to say we're partnering with Piedmont Health Services, which is a very successful community health center organization in the area that has 6 community health centers, as well as a program for the elderly. And their mission is to serve these rural underserved patients of North Carolina, which fits very well with this track in the residency program. So these residents, when they go to clinic, instead of going to our family medicine center on the UNC campus, they will be going to the Prospect Hill Community Health Center, which is in southern Caswell County, and they'll be seeing patients at this community health center and being trained mostly by real community health center family physicians who have years of experience working with underserved patients in this rural part of the state.
You know, Evan, as we were working on this grant and as I was taking in my role as residency director, this is one of the things that I really reflected on, how important this work is to train doctors to have the skills they need, just as you sought out those years ago in your training, to have those skills to take care of vulnerable populations and to help them and nurture them to go into these communities in need. And with your background and your passion for teaching and just the person that sits before me, it's so exciting to have you at the helm of it, really leading the charge for it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, it's a terrific opportunity, and I think we're going to be very successful. The students we've attracted so far are, you know, the ideal candidate that you'd want. They want to really engage with their community. They're very intelligent, highly motivated young physicians, and I'm very excited about
the
future
sound
of this.
Like,
me too.
They sound like perhaps they're the Evan Ashkins of their of their day. So we've been talking with Dr. Evan Ashkin, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at University of North Carolina. Thank you so much for sharing some of your journeys. This is a journey that is probably only halfway done, so and the work is great. And thank you for doing that work and sharing your experiences with us.
Well, thanks for having me and letting me tell part of my story. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Evan. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes, Christy, talking about health questions and concerns from our listeners.
And if you are listening and you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Adam, we've got some good questions today.
Yeah, we're going to hear from someone who had an unfortunate accident where they dropped something on their toe, a question about lime in the tap water and its impacts on health.
About drinking wine at dinner, whether that is healthy, and a little bit about bubble baths in children.
Okay, well, let's listen to our very first question about an unfortunate accident they had.
Hi, I dropped a boat hatch cover on my toe the other day, and it's discolored and quite painful. Is there anything I can do to minimize that?
That has a fancy name called a subungual hematoma, where you get that dark...
Quit saying mean things about me. Subungual you.
It sounds...
Below ungual, the part of the toe underneath the nail.
Uh-huh. And it can get black and dark, and it's really like full of blood that gets right under the nail that can
incredibly
happen.
Painful, right?
That's very not, painful, yeah. And can happen right after you drop something. I mean, this is a classic story of dropping something on your toe and getting this painful, discolored part of your nail.
Have you ever heard of one of the old home remedies for it? Where you take a super hot pin and you just heat it up and you put that pin right on top of the nail bed and it just dissolves the keratin, the superficial layer, and the blood squirts out.
I know. I've never done that at home, but we do that in the office, something similar. We usually now use a little hot...
cauterizer.
Thank you. Looking for the word.
You don't just take a match with a pen.
No. There's a little cautery tool that we can use that is just gets really, really hot on like a ballpoint pen sized little spot. And you can just put it right on the nail and it will burn a little hole through and let that blood release. And it feels a lot better. You can do it with a needle also.
But for those of you who don't want to do this at home, and we don't recommend if you really don't know, put pressure on it immediately and ice on it immediately. Compression and ice. Those are two biggest things to cut down on that bleeding from happening when you stub your toe really bad or drop something on your toenail or your fingernail.
And if it's in within the first day or two, go on to your doctor and see if they can help relieve it for you.
Yep. Hopefully that will be helpful. And don't drop a boat hatch cover anymore.
That is
that
good advice,
Adam.
That
doesn't sound like a good thing to do. Well, let's listen to our very next house call, Christy.
If there is a high concentration of lime in your water, is that bad for your health?
Well, I did some looking on this one because lime in your water, I know, you think about chemicals that are in the water, but I, of course, put lime in my water
a
lot
of
times.
Lime juice and lemon juice, lime-flavored water, bottled water, those are good things for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've got problems with acid in digestion, because typically citrus things that you put into your water will make it a little bit more acidic. But for most people, that's just not a problem.
Right. For most people, it's not a problem. I think it sounds like you may have a specific situation with the high concentration of lime in your water. And if that's
the water supply, right.
In the water supply. And I'd encourage you to have that checked. You can go to your county water authority or call your state health department and figure out the best way to get your water tested. I mean, recommendations about any potential changes that need to be made.
Lime is probably the top, chemical in terms of its annual weight that's put in industrial water supplies. And it's usually used to improve water quality, to soften water, the kind of hardening of water that's caused by calcium salts. And the lime helps remove that. And it also helps remove the arsenic that's natural in the environment. So lime in general is a good thing in the water supply. I've not heard of it being in too high a concentration.
Me either. So I think if you have a special situation, do call and have your water tested. You can send it off in a little tiny tube to the state health department, and they will help you get it analyzed.
Did you know, Christy, have you watched any of those old cowboy shows where they have the vaudeville-style medicine man traveling? You seen those?
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, one of the things they did to get people, the salesperson, to get the audience invested in the show is they would have a kind of a volunteer who was one of their people come in and blow through a straw into a glass of what was water with lime in it. And the carbon dioxide that was blown into it by the person would turn the water cloudy. That's the chemical reaction when you mix carbon dioxide and lime. And then they would say they've got a cure for it. And you know what they'd bring out? They'd bring out their panacea, their cure, and it was actually vinegar. When you pour the vinegar into the precipitate of the lime and the carbon dioxide, it clears it up. And that's how they would convince people that their potent formula, vinegar, cured disease. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it sounds like magic.
So next time you are watching the vaudeville show on the cowboy shows, you'll know that where it comes from.
Thank you so much for that important information. Okay, let's take our next house call question.
I have a question for your health. Is a glass of wine with dinner a healthy option?
Well, you got right to the point on this one, right? Is a glass of wine a healthy option? You're going to make us come down and maybe come down on what we think right or wrong. What do you think, Chris?
Well, there have been lots of studies about this, and you guys know, and we've talked about it on the show before, that there are some benefits in studies to drinking red wine. And I saw a recent, what we call a meta-analysis, where they put different studies together to try to figure out the absolute answer. And there was some evidence of a benefit to drinking light or to moderate wine consumption and a decrease in heart disease risk. So this is not drinking and saying, oh, it's good for me. This is, you know, less than or equal to one glass of wine at night for women and up to two for men. So it's, you know, that adds up in a week. So you have to be careful not to take the wrong message.
Well, and it's also calories.
Yes, it is.
There. But it clearly, a glass of wine and dinner, I think there is more evidence that it's healthy than not healthy for most people who don't have some underlying reasons not to do it.
So I would go over that in your particular situation with your doctor.
Good advice, Christy. Well, let's go to our last question. Very interesting one about bubble bath.
When I had little girls to raise, I was taught by a pediatrician not to use bubble bath. According to the thought at the time, the bacteria could rise into the urethra with the bubbles and cause urinary tract infections. Is this still the teaching?
Well, Christy, did you take bubble baths when you were a kid?
Because
I know you were a kid.
I was a kid, and I was the third of three girls. And all the pictures of me are with my clothes on in the bubble bath. They always thought funny to take the picture of the baby with their clothes on in the bath. But and I have a daughter, and we do bubble baths sometimes. But this is a question about, you know, children who get frequent urinary tract infections, that the recommendation is sometimes to pay attention to bubble baths as possibly a place where you can get irritation and potentially get bacteria.
Well, I'm not as confident that our listeners' family had it, but they heard this, and I think that's the advice kind of we were transmitted as we were coming through medical school and residency, that, oh boy, the bubble bath can be a frequent cause of urinary tract infections. And so we looked a little bit into this question in the literature, and we don't find much support for this. There's not much evidence that bubble bath really causes urinary tract infections. Actually, almost none.
My take on this is bubble baths are fine. But if you have a child or a grandchild who has a lot of urinary tract infections, it's worth a conversation with your doctor. It's worth considering stopping for a little while and seeing if there's a difference.
Because it can be an irritant to the outside, particularly for some children, the vulva. It can be an irritant to that aspect. And there, a lot of websites will say don't use it, things like the National Kidney Foundation. But the data that we see says there's not really conclusive evidence of that. And then you have to take it into account that, is this something enjoyable to you and your children?
Yeah. Well, thank you guys for calling, for writing and sharing your questions with us. And hopefully we've given some answers that are helpful to you and your health.
Yep. And we will maybe put up on our website, Christy, some information about where people can get water tested and some more information about the wine. Maybe our health sciences library folks can help us get that information up on our website. And you can send your own questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And you can also visit us at yourhealthradio.org, as well as follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Evan Ashkin. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL. 1360 WCHL wants to connect with you online for updates on our lifestyle programs, awesome giveaways, contests, trivia, community photos, breaking news, and more. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/chapelboro and become our fan on Facebook, and always connect with us online at chapelboro.com.